From our nation's capital, this is Naps Chat.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter and make believe it came from you.
Hi, and welcome to this week's episode of Naps Chat. I'm Bob Levy, the Director of Legislative and Political Affairs for the National Association of Postal Supervisors. 2 months ago, I explored with you, my Naps Chatters, the contours underlying and the implications for the future of the so-called Comstock Act, a law dating back to 1873, inspired by a postal inspector that tasked our nation's postal system into being this country's morality police, particularly with regard to the malleability of contraceptives and pharmaceuticals that could terminate a pregnancy, and information relating to those medical products. As a result, the Postal Service finds itself today in the unpleasant position of being in the middle of the debate over abortion. Another major legal issue in which the Postal Service now finds itself in the midst of is the debate over the limits of religious accommodation in the workplace. On April 18th this year, the United States Supreme Court will hear oral argument in the case of Groff versus DeJoy, a case in which a former postal employee, due to his strong religious convictions, refused to deliver mail on Sunday, his Sabbath or day of rest. Mr. Groff was disciplined by the Postal Service for his refusal to work on his Sabbath and consequently separated from the agency. He subsequently sued the United States Postal Service for its failure to accommodate his religious practice. So now his case is before the highest court in the land. With me today to discuss the case of Groff v. DeJoy and its potential implications for the Postal Service, as well as for other federal agencies, and in fact, most public and private employers, is Nicholas Reeves of Yale Law School's Free Exercise Clinic. Nick is also counsel to the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty. Nick filed a Friend of the Court brief, otherwise known as an amicus curiae brief, in support of the issues raised by former postal employee and former rural letter carrier Gerald Groff on behalf of a number of religious organizations, including one on which I serve as a board member. Mr. Reeves is a graduate of the University of Virginia Law School and received his undergraduate degree from the University of Notre Dame. Welcome to Naps Chat, Nick.
Bob, it's great to be with you.
I'm curious, what got you interested in religious liberties and the free exercise of religious beliefs, a rather boutique area of the American legal system?
You know, I saw a few cases going up to the Supreme Court while I was in law school. And at the time, it piqued my interest because it's an issue, you know, of personal importance to me. And now I've been working at the Beckett Fund for 5 years. And it has become such a great joy to be able to represent people of so many different faiths, from Hindus to Buddhists, Muslims. I've had the pleasure of working with people of numerous faiths, and that has just been an incredibly rewarding experience.
For our listeners, can you explain what is an amicus brief, and why did Yale's Free Exercise Clinic get involved in this particular case?
Absolutely. So an amicus brief, like you said, is also called a friend of the court brief. And what it means is we're not an actual party to the case, but we're telling the court that there's something important about this case and that we have an interest in how it resolves this. So specifically for the Yale Free Exercise Clinic, we represented a number of religious minority groups. And what we were telling the court is these groups in particular are concerned about this case because they're Saturday Sabbath observers. And in their experience, they've seen how other states have been able to better accommodate religious observance, including Sabbath observance, and how it hasn't caused problems for businesses to operate. So we were putting that information before the court.
If someone wanted to raise this issue, do you approach them or do they approach you when you sort of make a decision to file a friend of the court brief?
It really depends. You know, the Yale Free Exercise Clinic has as its mission to represent politically disadvantaged religious minorities. That can come to be when people reach out to us, or if we see a case that raises an issue that we think might be important to religious minorities in particular, we might reach out and ask if someone wants to file. So it goes both ways.
And the parties that you're representing, in this Friend of the Court brief are Seventh-day Adventist groups and National Orthodox Jewish Organization, correct?
Exactly.
Now, what did the Postal Service do to warrant the lawsuit originally brought by Graf?
Well, I guess it's actually really what the Postal Service didn't do. You know, Mr. Graf had been working as a rural carrier associate since 2012. And for the first couple years, he wasn't required to work on his Sabbath, which is Sunday. And then in 2015, the Postal Service signed a contract with Amazon to deliver more packages on Sundays. And, you know, there was a whole back and forth for 4 years where he was briefly accommodated. They found volunteers to fill his shifts on Sundays, and then he moved to a different postal office where they weren't delivering packages. But long story short, in 2019, the Postal Service ultimately said, because of the amount of work we're doing on Sundays and the burden that accommodating you has on your coworkers, we actually can't accommodate you. So they escalated discipline, and he ultimately resigned and sued the Postal Service.
What is religious accommodation? What are its limits? What are its constraints? Is it narrow? Is it broad? What is it?
So Title VII is a federal statute that defines what is required here. And the language it uses is a reasonable accommodation. So courts have said that it doesn't have to be an employee's preferred accommodation, but it has to resolve the conflict. So, but taking a step back, I mean, more generally, a religious accommodation is anything that, you know, would change the employee's working conditions or hours to allow them to both observe their religious practice and complete the job that they need to do. In terms of how burdensome it will be on the employer, that is what this case really is about.
It's funny, the Postal Service for quite some time has had 6-day delivery, which means one would argue 6 days a week is a work week, and then you hold one day for a Sabbath. But when Amazon contract was signed into the agreement between Bezos, or as a representative for Amazon and the Postal Service at that time, that idea of a 6-day delivery schedule sort of went out the window, and that's the reason, in part, why we're here today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is right. That was a change that started in 2015, and I think has accelerated since then.
What are the issues involved in this particular case?
This case is basically a direct challenge to a prior Supreme Court decision from 1977. And that case is called TWA versus Hardison. And in that case, the Supreme Court was interpreting the Title VII statute I mentioned earlier. And the language in Title VII said employers have to provide a reasonable accommodation unless doing so would impose an undue hardship on the employer's business. What the Supreme Court said in 1977 was that an undue hardship actually means anything more than a de minimis, or you could also say minimal, burden on the employer. So basically, the Supreme Court took what should be a high standard. It's not just a hardship. It has to be an undue hardship. So you have to think significant difficulty or expense. And they said, really, if any minor inconvenience happens to the employer, they don't have to provide the accommodation. And that's been really harmful to a number of religious practitioners, especially minority faiths, which is something we cover in our amicus brief, who've been denied workplace accommodations because the employer has said, yeah, we might be able to accommodate you, but it would be inconvenient. So we're just going to deny your accommodation instead.
I want to dig a little bit deeper here, because here we're dealing with the United States Postal Service. So let's, on the top level, at 20,000 feet, should a federal agency be treated differently under a religious accommodation standard than, say, a private employer?
Yeah, that's a good question. So Title VII, which is the federal workplace accommodation statute, applies equally to federal agencies and to private employers of a certain size. So, you know, on its face, the law doesn't distinguish between the two.
Now let's talk about specific workplaces. As you know, we have large post offices, let's say in cities like New York, Washington, D.C., Boston, San Francisco, L.A., that have a large number of employees that you could sort of adjust work schedules to accommodate that. In this place where Mr. Graf is involved, it was a small rural post office where there were far fewer employees in which to juggle schedules. Should that make a difference?
Yeah, I do think that's something the court would consider when it's making this determination of whether the hardship is undue. You know, you could certainly imagine in large postal services, it might not be any burden at all to have other workers fill in on Sundays, but in some small post offices, it might be more difficult. I think one thing about this case that makes it a more interesting case is the Postal Service acknowledged that they had other ways to deliver the mail and to deliver the packages. They said, despite Mr. Groff needing Sundays off, not a single package was lost or delivered late. And they said it didn't impose a significant cost on their operation. So I think your intuition is right, but actually the facts of this case, you know, the Postal Service conceded otherwise.
So the Postal Service in its argument before the court in its briefing to the Supreme Court did not argue that accommodating Mr. Groff would have in any way hindered the delivery of mail into the area that he was working?
That's right. When this came up in the lower courts and when they were kind of negotiating this with Mr. Groff, I think a postal supervisor, and then this ended up being the position of government, said it would be at most a minimal inconvenience. It wouldn't be a significant burden on our business or on the delivery of these packages to accommodate you. So that issue is not in dispute in this case.
So the dispute in this case is simply the refusal to accommodate? That's just the bottom line?
That's right. So what the Postal Service has said is, you know, we accommodated him for a while, but it has been a minimal burden. It's been inconvenient, so we don't have to accommodate him. That's what the Supreme Court said in Hardison. And then Mr. Groff is challenging that decision and saying what the court should do is actually engage in a rigorous analysis of whether it actually would impose, whether accommodating Mr. Groff would actually impose a significant burden or significant difficulty or expense on the Postal Service. So it's the difference in the legal standard is the question before the court.
So what are the possible outcomes? Like the court's going to hear oral argument on the 18th. They mm-hmm. could release a decision as early as in the end of June, when it usually sort of releases all the decisions for the immediate past term, or it could kick it back to the district court. But what are the possible outcomes?
That's right. So after the Supreme Court hears the case in April, we'll likely get a decision in June. I think there really are two main outcomes. One is the court decides to keep the TWA versus Hardison de minimis standard and says, yeah, we were right 40 years ago when we decided this case at the time. We think anything more than a small burden is enough to allow the employer to deny an accommodation. I think the more likely outcome is that the Supreme Court reverses the TWA versus Hardison decision and actually says, no, we were wrong 40 years ago when we interpreted the term undue hardship to mean any minimal or minor burden. Actually, the phrase undue hardship has some meat to it. It should mean something like a significant difficulty or expense. And that's the legal standard that the Americans with Disability Act has adopted. And that's the standard that a lot of other states and actually Canada has adopted as well to interpret the same term.
What was the vote total? What was the majority in the Hardison case that found that used the undue hardship standard?
I believe it was, I'm not 100% sure, actually. I believe it might have been a unanimous opinion at the time, or maybe there were a few dissents, but I'm not sure off the top of my head.
But the court is quite different in its ideology with regard to religious exercise and religious accommodation than it was 40 years ago, clearly. So one would suspect that they would be more receptive to the arguments that you are making and that Mr. Groff is making. One would anticipate.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, even just on its face, it's very strange to interpret this phrase undue hardship to mean a minimal burden. I think just from a textualist perspective, which is where the current court is, that's unlikely to fly. And then we also have 40 years of history with other statutes, with other states and with other jurisdictions imposing these higher burdens. And, you know, one thing we argued in our amicus brief is the sky hasn't fallen you know, it's not been significantly more difficult for businesses to operate if they have to provide these religious accommodations. So I think with more perspective, with a court that is more textualist, that does look at the statute and what the statute actually says, I do think it's very likely that the Supreme Court's going to reverse the Hardison decision.
So what they could do is reverse the Hardison decision, probably expand what an undue hardship is, to say it's more than just a minimal hardship. It has to be a meaningful hardship, let's say, whatever that term means. I don't think that, and then they kick it back or they remand it back to the district court to determine whether or not that burden has been met, or could they just make the decision right at the Supreme Court level and create that standard and basically evaluate it on its face at the Supreme Court?
Mm-hmm. I think what you said first is probably right. I think they're most likely to say, here's the new standard, but district court, you go back and look at the facts of this case and apply this standard. And, you know, then we'll know how it operated in this case. But what the Supreme Court would probably just do is change the law and then tell the lower courts how to implement.
What is Groff actually suing for?
So Mr. Groff is suing for an accommodation. So, you know, I'm not sure what that would look like in this case. It might be, you know, he gets his job back at the Postal Service. He might alternatively be suing basically for the monetary harm that was done to him. Instead of giving him his job back, they could agree to a certain amount of damages that would compensate him for the injury he suffered. I think that would have to be, again, determined probably in the district court when this case goes back down after the Supreme Court resolves it.
It's sort of like, you know, we have, just as an aside, the National Association of Postal Supervisors won a unanimous U.S. Court of Appeals decision for the District of Columbia Circuit, where they found for us, but they remanded it back to the district court to determine what the damages are incurred. So, no matter what happens, it's never the end of the story till till the lower court, you know, actually decides, applies the standard. Let me ask you another question about this, because I think our members, the members of the National Association of Postal Supervisors, our folks are the frontline managers. We're the supervisors in local stations, branches, and post offices, as well as the postmasters. If they are confronted with a situation where an employee, for religious belief, religious reasons, are unable to deliver or to deliver mail or perform a function on a particular religious holiday, using the standard that you would apply, what should that postal supervisor do?
Yeah, that's a great question. So under Title VII, especially if the Supreme Court does correct the Hardison standard, the requirement is a reasonable accommodation absent an undue hardship on the Postal Service. So practically speaking, what that would mean is the supervisor should work with the employee to try to find a way to allow them to both keep their job but also to observe their faith. And this would require some amount of, you know, reorganization of schedules, maybe some inconvenience to other employees, maybe even a small cost of hiring an additional worker, you know, for a few hours or something like that, or paying someone overtime. But at some point, you know, if the accommodation is too costly and would impose a significant difficulty or expense on the Postal Service, maybe it would mean not, you know, mail not getting delivered for, you know, in compliance with a contract or something like that, and there's no other way to do it, such that it would be significantly costly to the Postal Service, then you don't have to provide the accommodation. So that would be the standard that we've advocated for, and I think it's the standard the Supreme Court's most likely to adopt.
Fortunately, I don't think individual postal supervisors, postmasters, and frontline managers are going to make that decision outside of operational guidance from postal headquarters, because that would drive our folks batty trying to manage that without any type of guidance, particularly because a lot of most of our workforce, particularly the frontline employees who deliver the mail, process mail, and so forth, are under union contract, and there are seniority rules and workplace rules that would also have to be considered as mm-hmm. an attempt is made to accommodate work schedules for religious purposes. How do collective bargaining, within a world of collective bargaining agreements where you have seniority rules and you bid for days off and so forth, does this work? How does this dovetail with that type of situation?
Yeah, I think that's a little bit of an open question. So under the TWA versus Hardison standard, which is currently the rule before the Supreme Court's Groff decision may change that. But under the current standard, a collective bargaining agreement and union rules, you know, didn't have to be changed, didn't have to be altered to provide a religious accommodation. The court said, well, you know, making that change would be more than a minimal cost. So that's typically how things work now. I think after the Groff decision, it's very possible that the court, or maybe lower courts in the first instance, might say, well, you know, maybe there is some flexibility here. Maybe you do need to provide the accommodation and, you know, change the way some of these you know, union agreements work. So I don't think we know the answer to that question yet.
It's out for review. In any case, Nick, I do want to thank you for joining us this day on NAPS Chat.
It's absolutely my pleasure, Bob. It's great talking with you.
With that being the last word, I want to thank Nick Reeves of the Yale Free Exercise Clinic for joining me on NAPS Chat today and sharing his views on a brief that was filed before the United States Supreme Court on a oral argument that will take place on April 18th. And you could tune in on the Supreme Court website if you are interested in hearing oral argument. And I want to thank NAPS Chat listeners for logging on. If you enjoy NAPS Chat, please leave us a positive review in the Apple Podcast Store. And more importantly, share NAPS Chat with your friends and colleagues. Until our next program, stay safe and stay healthy.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter and make believe it came from you. I'm gone.